Hello, folks. It's your friend Bernie here, and welcome to this episode of the Co-Working Values Podcast. We have a guest host in, and I'm going to keep him as long as we can, and it's Tony Bacigalupi, who's one of the people on the planet that's been doing co-working the longest. And this whole series of podcasts is based around his belongingfulness project, and it's how we can get more connected in society, more connected as humans, how we can find ways to build community in our co-working spaces, which is what this podcast is about, but also in our local communities and with each other. And Tony is going to be speaking to people from all over the world in different disciplines outside of co-working as well, exploring how they help us as human beings come together in different places. And it's not always going to be a co-working space, but obviously that's the thing. The co-working movement is where we've invested our time and energy and what we believe in. So in this episode, he talks to John Alexander, who's from the UK, who's written an amazing book called Citizens, which is about how we can leave the consumer story behind and move into the citizen story, which I think is one of the most important things. The whole citizens movement is based around looking for others that are doing the same thing already and connecting with them rather than reinventing the wheel. And in London on the 16th of April, we have John Alexander coming to the London Co-Working Assembly Breakfast Show to talk about how co-working and citizenship can help bring people together in a very turbulent world. So I'm very positive about the hopes for this podcast and the future. So let's get into the show.
Okay, hello. John, thank you so much for taking the time to hang with me. Really appreciate it.
Very good to be here, Tony. Looking forward to it.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about your book, which I'm so excited that you wrote. I feel like we need to be having this conversation now, and more people just need to know what you've been writing. So tell me a little bit about just background. How did you end up being the guy to write the book with the big old word citizens on the cover? How'd that happen?
Mainly because for the first 10 years of my career, I had the big old word consumers printed all over my soul, man. and choking my soul in the process. No, look, I basically, the book is really an offer of a way of seeing the moment in time we're living in. It's me going, but we don't have to see all of this the way we are doing. There is a whole other lens. And the reason I can see that, the reason I got to that, is because I spent 10 years working in the advertising industry and asking deeper and deeper questions about what we're doing to ourselves when we start everything we do. When all of our institutions and organizations are built out of the idea that people are consumers, the idea that, like, the right thing to do is to pursue self-interest. The only thing we are capable of doing is pursuing self-interest. And on some sort of weird, like, Orwellian hypothesis that somehow self-interest is going to add up to the collective interest, that selfishness is selflessness, right? Like, and basically, because I spent 10 years working in the advertising industry, living and breathing through that lens, sort of in the fishbowl, in the sort of right in the deepest depths of the fishbowl of that idea, I guess I became the person who can see that doesn't have to be the idea we're working with, but also can see the consequences of it.
Yeah. You mentioned in the book that you literally got sick to your stomach for like a full week straight every day. So it's something to that effect. And
yeah, right. Basically, I mean, my first boss described my job to me, first boss in an ad agency described my job to me by saying, what you've got to remember is the average consumer sees something like 3,000 commercial messages a day, and your job is to cut through that. You've got to make yours the best. And you know, for a while I was good with that, like competition, like make mine the best. And then I just started to ask questions like, what are we doing to ourselves when we tell ourselves we're consumers 3,000 odd times a day? Like, what is that doing to our relationships with one another, to what we even believe is possible, to what we can even imagine? And when you ask those questions for long enough while sitting at a desk in an ad agency, you start to feel pretty shaky. And it just got to the point where as I really began to see what I now see really is a kind of religion, like in the worst possible sense, like a kind of dogma, like a set of rules and a frame through which to understand reality that you are not allowed to break. And I was working as a priest, like, and I was starting to see that this thing, this idea of ourselves, is just a story and a deeply limiting, dangerous story. And it just got to the point where, like, in a very embodied way, I just couldn't do it. Like, I was on Oxford Circus tube station and this thing just kind of took over me and I was physically sick on the platform, like it is. And then at some point, you know, you have to quit, but yeah, that's what it took to get me out of there.
And then that led to new citizenship.
Yeah, a little indirectly. There was a little time of recovery and learning to love oneself again and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I began to ask another question, a kind of more generative question, rather than just staring at what are we doing to ourselves when we tell ourselves we're consumers constantly. I started asking what would it look like to put all that creative energy into inviting people into their agency as citizens, into stepping into an idea of ourselves, not just as kind of selfish, inherently self-interested creatures, but as collaborative, creative, caring creatures who kind of want to make the world a better place. So if we're given the opportunities and the structures and the stories to enable us and inspire us to do so. And that's really where new citizenship came from. It was going like, how can we hold a space for this conversation? How can we try and ask organizations what they think they would do and be if they saw people, if they started with that foundational thing of like, what if this organization saw people as citizens, not just as consumers? And so that's really what New Citizenship Project is and has been, is a kind of consultancy business, but really a research project with a terrible consultancy business model. You know the thing where like consultants who actually make money do the same thing for lots of different people and charge them escalating amounts of money for it. And what we've done over the last 10 years is like do different things for lots of different people and charge them minuscule amounts for it.
Which I suppose the silver lining of that is that you end up with a really well-rounded, holistic perspective that can inform a book.
Right. And we've seen in so many different contexts the possibility and the opportunities of this. And then when I sort of got to the point really, at the end of 2019, after the UK general election and then when COVID hit was when I really sort of started really committed to the book, and not just because I was locked up at home, but just going like, I feel like I can see something that I need more people to be able to see. And I feel ready enough to put that out into the world. There was a day in the UK when our government changed their kind of COVID messaging, and it began with a very, actually, what I now actually work through three stories of the individual and society. So I don't just talk about consumer and citizen. I also talk about the subject story. And at that time when COVID hit in the UK, our government was very much in subject mode. It was sort of saying, stay home, do as you're told, we'll look after you little people. and the bargain of the subject story only works if you are actually protected, and you never actually are. And so as the UK death rate started to escalate, there was this moment when they changed gear, changed message, and went to a place, went back to the consumer story, went, actually, look out for yourselves. Like, it's your individual responsibility. If you look after yourself, you'll be fine. If they don't look after themselves, that's why they'll get sick. It's back to that logic of self-interest is the dominant factor.
And then there was
crazily in the UK, we got as far as there was a campaign, government campaign in the summer of 2020 called Eat Out to Help Out. literally co-opting this kind of citizen instinct into consumption. Because what was actually happening was that people were volunteering and doing mutual aid groups in their communities and street WhatsApp groups. And there was so much kind of, when disaster struck, when the pandemic struck, people's instinct was to look out for one another. People's instinct was to get involved because that's who we are. And I saw this and was like, just how I can't not. And I wrote a blog that day that on my blog that until that point had like 50 views, and someone sent me a packet of Maltesers to say thank you. Like, and that day, that blog went crazy. It got 750,000 views in 48 hours. And it was like, and that was the moment where I was like, I have to get this out there. I have to offer this into the world. So yeah, that's why I wrote the book.
Yeah, that's incredible. And I feel like the pandemic provides such a powerful encapsulation of a lot of different storylines. But in terms of this particular dynamic of subject, you know, consumer and citizen, we had anybody who lived through that time, who's old enough, you know, not like anybody who lived through the pandemic time, remembers vaguely, at least, there was a time right when it struck when we were all citizens and we were all united. We were all there to help each other. We were all kind of empowered. And then these various dynamics arose, as you said, the kind of the subject of, you know, we're subjects of, you know, the authority that we all have to do what we're told. We all have to kind of comply. And then somewhere along the line, we all became kind of self-interested consumers again. And it's tragic, but we also kind of got a taste of what's possible in there.
Yeah, it's in there. And I think like the lesson, there's a wonderful book by Rebecca Solnit, a book called A Paradise Built in Hell, where she looks back at the experience of disaster through human history and finds that this happens every time, actually.
Yeah. But
we're sort of conditioned to believe that when disaster strikes, the veneer of civilization, as the language, will be peeled away and we'll kind of eat each other. And actually the opposite is true. What actually happens is that when the veneer of civilization is removed, the deeper truth of humanity as collaborative citizens at least briefly comes through, but then the stories can be reimposed. And that's the critical thing to understand. And particularly with the consumer story, it's very powerful, very capable. Like in its dynamics, it co-opts the attempts to kind of remove itself and reshapes them. Like I'm writing something. I was interviewed the other day for the New York Times about the phenomenon of citizen branding. Where this language is being used for coffee shops and banks and so on. And it's this really interesting thing of like, to what extent, how can we use those moments as opening doors to an idea of ourselves rather than allowing these deeper opportunities and possibilities to be co-opted. And I think we're living in this incredibly important moment in time. Like I really do believe this. I think we're living in a moment when the consumer story, like in its most fundamental form, is falling apart. Like the simple fact is that the crises of our time, the multiple crises of our time, are symptoms of that collapse, and because they are manifestations of the consumer story, you have a crisis of loneliness, and because you have a story that says that humans are independent, isolated individuals, right? And you can't solve that crisis from within that story. You have a crisis of inequality. Because you have a story that says that the right way to live is to climb the ladder, to compete with the other, to try and, because a rising tide will lift. And it's nonsense. And so the result is, the inevitable result is internal inequality in societies and global inequality. It's designed in. And so you can't solve those crises from within that story. And most fundamentally for me, you have an ecological crisis because you have a story that says that we're separate from nature. You have a story that says that happiness is the accumulation of material possessions. And you can't solve an ecological crisis from within that story. So the story is breaking. But the really dangerous thing is that as that story breaks in the vacuum that's resulting in the moment, what so many of us know it's broken. But the only people who are actually calling that out are the people who'd replace it with the subject story.
With the subject.
Who come up and say, the system's broken, I will fix it. I will protect you. And that bargain of protection in return for obedience is exactly what happened during COVID as well. But it's such a false bargain. And the real opportunity, the logic that might actually work in our times is the citizen logic, which says actually all of us are smarter than any of us. The right thing to do isn't just to keep your head down and do as you're told and be protected, nor is it just to pursue self-interest and hope against hope that adds up to the collective interest. It's actually to get involved, to contribute your ideas, energy and resources to the pursuit of the best society as a whole. And critically, and this I think is the difficult part, for the organizations and institutions of our society to reorient themselves to tap into that. We have to reinvent and redesign our organizations in this time and our institutions to be about unleashing and harnessing and in a really constructive way, like the power of our collective agency, not to be about either commanding us or serving us. But that work is, It's on a damn timescale, man. Like it's,
yeah.
It's nothing fast.
Yeah. So, and to your point, it does seem like we're in a place where something is shifting. And I like that you introduce this notion of the subject to contrast the consumer, because it's very easy to paint the consumer culture as being just kind of this caricature of bad. But there's a reason it's so attractive, because it's cool that we get to live in a society where we can go out and buy whatever we want, where we can, you know, accumulate things. Like, it's fun. It's attractive for a reason. But at the same time, we're now at a place where it's so maximized that it's starting to feel like we're maybe sobering up a little bit, that we're feeling the hangover of that a little bit. As we're recording, this is the day after the Super Bowl here in the US. So there was the most frequent and annoying ads were for Temu.com, which, you know, hawks like the cheapest stuff you could possibly get, most disposable, like just reaching this like breaking point of, you know, maybe we're just doing a little too much of this. And now what I find interesting is there is this, certainly this movement, this subject movement of maybe we need to go that direction.
What's so interesting?
There is a citizen movement too, and so yeah, go jump in.
No, just jumping in on the Super Bowl thing. I'm writing something at the moment to try and get out there pretty quickly. But the year 1984 is super powerful in this, and the ad, the most famous ad in history, is the Apple ad, the takeoff of the film 1984 and the book, that screened for the one and only time in the middle of Super Bowl 1984, right?
Yeah,
and the end line of that ad, the idea, the sort of Big Brother's voice projects forth from a giant screen, and then the woman, this young girl who represents Apple, kind of runs on and smashes the screen with a hammer, and this voiceover rolls that goes, on January 24th, Apple will release Macintosh, and you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984. And forget the appalling accent, sorry, Lee, But the whole point of that moment was to say consumerism is what will save us from uniformity and conformity and the disappearance of the individual. And it was a kind of golden dream, because what the idea of ourselves as consumers and not subjects offered was the agency of individual choice, the agency of individualism, the agency of creating ourselves. And that was an incredible promise. And in 1984, other things happened as well. So Band-Aid was that year. So the idea you could buy stuff to solve global poverty. Body Shop launched on the stock exchange that year, the idea you can buy stuff to save the planet. Like, this wasn't a selfish thing in that sense of the word. It was like, really ironically, an Orwellian idea that, so as I say, that selfishness is selflessness. And so it was addictive, and we grabbed it, but not because we're bad, right? Like,
yeah.
But we thought we were being good.
Yeah.
And this is the critical thing to understand. Humans are not like, we're not bad creatures. But what we do is we get trapped in stories. And that's where we are right now. And so this moment, I think, and it's so, like, I love your juxtaposition, like this conversation juxtaposing the Apple ad for this grand, like, minute-long theatrical thing directed by Ridley Scott, that ad was,
yeah.
Right? Like, it was millions of dollars of production budget. And now where are we in Super Bowl advertising with, like, freaking Tenet? What more do you need to see that how broken this thing is? Like,
yeah,
it's a caricature of itself. But as you say, like, as that collapses, the subject movement is the only, the great thing I worry about right now is that we have this subject and consumer moment where the only people who will call out the breakage are the people who would actually replace it with authoritarianism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we have to, but there is something building. Like, it's taking shape in so many ways and places, and it's been building for quite a long time. And also it has always been there. Like, it's in, it, when you go to any given place, one of my favorite writers is the Turkish writer, Ece Temelkuran. And she talks about, like, the world looks so dark from a long lens, but when you use a narrow lens, when you get close up, you find the brightness everywhere. Like, it's in every community. There are people doing stuff. There are people organizing together. There are people crossing political divides. There are people building the energy. So the task is, like, how do we connect that up? How do we make it visible to itself and beyond? And then how do we challenge and change the institutions so they come in behind that rather than seeing their role as being to protect us from ourselves or serve us or some nonsense?
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about that, because I feel like, you know, I always want to try to lean towards highlighting solutions and empowering. And, you know, somebody who's tuning into this conversation, I want someone to come away saying, I can go do something. So I'm curious, from your book, from your research, what do you find the most encouraging about what you're seeing? What's something that, you know, me as maybe a disillusioned consumer, that I can go find and participate in that helps to, you know, create this better future?
Oh God, man! Name your juice, and I'll make you something special. Well, so just the other day, I went to the launch party of the National Park City Visitor Centre in London. The National Park City movement is a phenomenal thing. It's like, could be one of the biggest ideas of the 21st century. The idea is working with community organisations across a city, kind of work to connect up the nature corridors, but also the opportunities to get people out into green space, collaborate together to build the idea that we can reinvent our cities as places to live alongside nature rather than be separate from it. And this movement, London is the world's first sort of official national park city, and there's been some phenomenal work there. But Adelaide joined in 2021. There's now 25 cities, including, I think, 4 in the US. I know Chattanooga is one of them, that are working towards this certification. And it's a combination of these little grassroots organizations and then coming together with city administrations. But if you just live anywhere in a city and there's a park, like, go tell your friends of the local park about the National Park City certification, connect up with the other friends of parks in the city, connect and transform your whole city, because that's what's possible and that's what people are doing all over the world. I could talk about, one of my favorite examples of what's happened since the book is, as a little independent outdoor retailer in the French Alps who had, because they're worried about sustainability, you can see climate change happening all around them. They had shifted a lot of their business model to be about upcycling and reuse and repair. And read the book, and then they decided that they wanted to see, because a big message of the book is look for where the others are. Don't try and do it on your own. They put the flag up and tried to say, put the bat signal up, and were like, who else is trying to do this? They found and now there's a network of 40 odd independent outdoor retailers all over the world called the Reaction Collective. And then just before Black Friday last year, they decided that they couldn't stand the idea of Black Friday. It's such a sort of consumer thing. And so they started a campaign called Citizen Friday, where their call to action was share, repair, and get out there. And they got hundreds of businesses involved in it with like a couple of weeks' notice, and got on TV in a couple of countries. And so everywhere though, and I could talk about employee groups in organizations, or I could talk about community organizations in a whole load of different places, or like I could go on and on. The core of it though is always the same. The first step is like, know that others will be feeling it too. The second step is like, find them. And the third is like, decide what to do together, right? It's like, because when you do that, and this I think is like what co-working spaces, the sort of the original dream of them was, right? Like, was how do we create a space where people who are working for something they believe in can find their collective agency instead of just doing it on their own. But yeah, but that's the essence of it. That's the absolute thing that shines through.
It's amazing, John, you have anticipated and segued into everything I was planning to segue into before I do it. And it's just, you make it so easy. I appreciate that. one of the first co-working spaces, not the first, but in San Francisco was called Citizen Agency, or Citizen Space, actually. And it was run by people who ran an agency called Citizen Agency. And the multiple interpretations of that were all very intentional. One of the things that I find very interesting about the moment we're in from a co-working perspective is that over the course of the last 18 or so years, there has been this movement building, which at times was very visible, at times was co-opted by kind of consumer culture, WeWork style, office space sharing. But really, it has all of the elements of an evil plan, except for the fact that it's not evil, that it was it's a decentralized movement. It was based on wikis and open source blogs and forums. That's how I got involved. I just started talking with people and everyone was just sharing their ideas. And so we now have, this is the evil plan, we now have local community gathering spaces, thousands of them all over the world, that are doing good work, many flying under the radar, that are embedded into our communities. And what I'm finding it keeps me up at night, is that there is this untapped potential to activate and coordinate and inspire the people who run these spaces to take action in their local communities. And a lot of them are doing this already. They're doing volunteering, they're doing blood drives, they're getting active in their democracy. But what I'm curious about, just for you, with your book, with what you are doing, is that I'd be curious what you would want to see happen. You know, what would be your dream as I'm describing this? You must be getting a little excited. What would you want to see somebody who runs a co-working space who might be tuning into this, you know, what would you want to see them make use of in that space? What would you want to see them do?
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a good question. So the first thing I want to say is just to be kind of clear about, because I think it really, one of the things I love about the working with the ideas I work with is that they offer a really helpful clarity about, that helps you not do what you don't want to do anyway. And helps you name and see when you are at risk of being co-opted by the context and by the story. And so So I think that in a way, the first like offer I would make is of that frame of the consumer story to understand why the kind of WeWork phenomenon happens and why it's so screwed up. Like the notion that what you are, that when you transactionalize the whole phenomenon, you are actually destroying it. But also offering, because you offer the citizen frame, you can say, so what, in how then do I have a business model? Because that's the question that always drags us back into the consumer story, the how do I have a business model? But the offer of the citizen story, the offer of the logic is people don't have to just buy from you because you believe in them and they believe in you. What you can do is they can buy into what you're trying to do. And that actually can be a much more financially sustainable, much more financially resilient relationship. And one of the examples that I set out in the book is of the UK nonprofit, the National Trust, where the work I was involved in over a period of years was all about saying, like, how do we make our cause more visible? How do we make what we're overall trying to do here? Doesn't mean that everyone has to like everyone who comes through the door is immediately signing up to everything we say and want to believe in. But what they are doing is they know that when they're handing money over to us, they're buying into something, they're contributing to something. It's that the purchase is an act of participation rather than just an act of consumption. And when that happens, then you're opening the door to something. So that sort of how to see when the business model is co-opting you rather than you using a business model to do what you're trying to do. And that leads me to the sort of second point, which is how can we be more explicit about what these places are and are trying to be? Like, how do we make more visible the idea that these are kind of places to find collective agency, places to be more than just your own initiative and your own self, places to combine with other and find serendipity that can lead to more. And in many cases, find place-based agency as well. And this I think would be the thing I'd get really excited about. And I've seen it. I know some of the Impact Hub network reasonably well. And I think examples like Impact Hub Oakland and when it existed, Impact Hub Birmingham in the UK were quite explicit about what they're really trying to do in the world is bring together people who are going to contribute something to ideas and initiatives and businesses to making those cities thrive. And the thing about that is, people want to be part of meaningful work in the world. People want to be part of something bigger than themselves. And you give them the opportunity to buy into that, you're actually creating something very powerful that can work for you as well. The mini tangent, but one of the craziest and scariest, but also most weirdly reassuring experiences from the research for the book was I took a few steps carefully into the QAnon conspiracy. And the fascinating thing about that is that the opening steps that you take are all steps that say, we need you here. You have a role. You can be part of something. And when you think about the messaging that's coming out of our politics most of the time, it's like, don't worry, we'll look after you, we'll sort it for you. Like, and this is this idea of speaking to, appealing to the agency that people really want to feel they have is incredibly powerful. And then like we could go off on a whole thing about like, oh man, like what I would do actually if I could get hold of the co-working movement as a whole. Yeah. The first thing I would do would be, I love to work through a method that's called appreciative inquiry. So, and what you do is you say, what's the best of what's already going on here? And how do we build on that? How do we connect it up? How do we do more of it? Rather than sort of abstractly going, what's the opportunity that we could impose back into this thing? You're like, the trick is if you see people as citizens, then your starting point is they're already freaking amazing. Somewhere they're already going to be doing it.
Yeah.
And we just have to find that, celebrate it, platform it so others can see it, and then connect it up so that it can become an institution. Like, you don't have to I can't and I shouldn't stand outside it and go, actually, I think from an abstract citizenship perspective, I think you're fine. It's the most effective thing to do. It's there already. We just need to find it, tell stories about it, platform it, make it famous, and then it'll then it'll fly.
I really appreciate that. It's a very wise perspective, and it's something that some people are doing. My dear friend Ashley Proctor is running a program called the Coworking Idea Project, which highlights some of these stories on a monthly basis and gives people prompts to say, hey, you know, here's something someone else is doing. Maybe you want to try it in your space. And, you know, why not? That's how this all started, was we just started doing stuff and then copying each other and inviting each other to kind of take the good ideas and run with them. And maybe now is a good time to remember our roots in that regard. So I appreciate that.
One thing I would love to see, having now said, like, I shouldn't come up with any ideas for you, but I have got one.
Go for it. Yeah.
It's basically to connect this thing in with the deliberative democracy and participatory democracy movement. Like, how do co-working spaces start to interact with citizens' assemblies and these kind of things? And how do we not wait for permission to be granted? There's a lovely line, I can't remember the name of the black activist community organizer who said something like, if you can't get them to give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair.
Yeah.
And it's like, and particularly in the US, where I know co-working spaces are really really widespread and probably aren't that connected up from what I understand, like that this the deliberative democracy movement is really struggling to take hold. These ideas of citizen assemblies, randomly selected representative samples of a population of a city or country coming together to deliberate on a difficult issue and make sort of recommendations for what should be done about it. There's been a few in the US, but they're way behind the rest of the world. Like, there's one in Petaluma in California about what to do with an old fairground site, for example, that's worth looking up. But the idea that co-working spaces could become a kind of a space where these things could happen out of hours, but a thing that the participants, the members of a co-working space could come together and identify the issue and contribute to and be a kind of, don't be shy to be a kind of alternative, provide an alternative way of governing in a sense, an alternative governance space for a city, because we need those things. Like, we're going to have to, I'm a big fan of politicians. I think a lot of them are really good human beings who are trying to do things the right way. But they're going to need us to find ways to create the spaces and the processes for them to evolve into, because the systems and structures that they're working in just aren't fit for purpose. And I think as a really fundamental system thing, like, that would be the idea of co-working spaces as civic spaces in the fullest sort of democratic sense of the word, spaces where an alternative, deeper, richer form of democracy can take hold. That, I think, is possible and could be very powerful.
I just looked up the quote. It's Shirley Chisholm, the first African-American woman elected to the United States Congress. And I love the fact that, I mean, to be in that position, you got to be a very engaged citizen and a very optimistic one. And I dare say, I feel like we're creating new tables for people to pull up their chairs to. And that gives us new ways to kind of elevate our voices through these co-working communities. John, this has been so exciting. I feel like we're starting a very exciting conversation, and I hope other folks who hear this kind of tune in and maybe not just consume this, but let's have a conversation. John, you're John Alex on Twitter.
John J. Alex on Twitter.
John J. Alex. Excuse me. I have it written correctly. John J. J-O-N J. Alex on Twitter. And I'm Tony B. Good. So tag us. Talk to us about this conversation. And John, where else do we find you on the internet?
I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. I haven't been doing so much on the site that Elon Musk is doing his best to destroy, but I'm on LinkedIn, and I am also I have a website, johnalexander.net, which has a mailing list on it that I'm currently working towards kind of shifting into a bit more of a many-to-many conversation that I'd love to have some co-working fiends involved in. So yeah, find me there.
Great. And your book is also there, johnalexander.net. So that's if you're interested in the Citizen's book, which I cannot recommend enough, John, J-O-N, alexander.net. And John, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Tony. See you again soon.
All right.
Hello, folks. Thanks for your time and attention on this episode of the Co-Working Values podcast with John and Tony. Please head to the show notes because there's all the links mentioned in the show are in there, including additional resources. And wherever you listen to your podcast, please leave a review. It helps the show more than you can imagine. It also helps people in the wider general public world and your neighborhood understand what co-working is, how it can help their local community, and how it can help them build their careers and projects and work. Have a remarkable day. Be careful out there. It is a jungle.